Welcome to the final installment of the week-long series Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm your MC, Alan Minsky. On today's show, we'll hear from four of the most prominent voices on the American left: Norman Solomon, Ralph Nader, Cornel West, and Noam Chomsky. It's quite a show. Stay tuned. This is Alan Minsky, and the show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Norman Solomon is the author of many books, including War Made Easy. As an activist in the California Democratic Party, he co-authored the official position on Afghanistan, which is total military withdrawal. He is the co-chair of Healthcare, Not Warfare, launched by Progressive Democrats of America. And Norman Solomon has recently launched an exploratory committee looking into running for the U.S. House of Representatives in 2012. I'll also add that for a few decades now, Norman Solomon has been one of the leading progressive voices commenting on how media, and in particular political media, functions in the United States. Welcome to Building a Powerful Left in the United States, Norman Solomon.
Hey, thanks, Alan.
I want to start right off with the big question, the big framing question of this series, which is that there are so many reasons, given all of the problems in American society, from the unjust foreign wars, the healthcare crisis, the economic inequality, even before the economic crisis, but in particular, given the economic crisis and the severe unemployment that exists in the society, one would think, given the history of the left, that the left would become a concentrated force in society that people would gravitate towards in terms of expressing their feelings about politics, getting involved in transforming the society. As of right now, that hasn't been the case.
Well, there are a lot of factors, and certainly some of them are just out of our control. But as progressives, as people on the left, we have a lot more that we can and should do, I think. One is to just acknowledge to ourselves as we strategize that we have to deal with what is, that the kind of society and world we'd like to have is not in front of us by any means. And also, I think, as we talk now in 2011, to consciously turn away from two tendencies that I think have been very destructive, undermining the capacities of progressives to really make major headway politically across the board in the society. And one is just accommodation to the Democratic Party hierarchy now embodied in the White House, where the Obama administration has been so willing to conciliate itself and move towards the Republican Party and its positions, accommodate itself to and carry water for the Wall Street forces, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a huge problem. And, you know, in a nutshell, we need to make the case and make it clear that to move towards the Republican positions in any way, the corporate military stances that are so destructive, is to empower rather than to block the momentum of the Republican Party. Another problem, I think, which is significant and manifested quite often online on some of our even best websites in terms of the comments and discourse, and certainly on some of our own airwaves, is a self-marginalizing process, which includes basically to recuse ourselves, to pull back or continue to pull back, as we have, unfortunately, historically, since the 1980s, from the electoral process. And that has given more and more power and space to the right wing and to the corporate Democrats and the Blue Dogs to do what they do. When we rely simply on the politics of denunciation, when we leave it up to other forces in the society to fight over state power, including in elections, then I think we get what we've gotten, which is a continual push to the right that's been manifested in who wins elections, then who appoints the judges in the Supreme Court, and all the rest of it.
When you look at public opinion polls and issues are broken down one by one, the American public comes across as much, much more progressive, not only than the public policy put forward by the government, but even by the public policy put forward by the Democratic Party, at least on a broad array of issues that are very important to progressives, and particularly economic issues. So what's your vision for the ideas that you feel can animate a revitalized left in the United States and, given the work that you seem to be heading into in your life, that can be brought into effectively as part of a Democratic Party campaign and perhaps a representative of the people as a member of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Congress?
Well, I think, as you articulated, it's very true that the polls show on the issues, overall, there's a progressive majority in this country. It depends on how it's spun and how we speak to it. And, you know, as you note, as I'm moving into the electoral arena personally, I've tried to find ways to articulate that. And parenthetically, people can go to the web, just normansolomonexploratory.com, and see how I've spelled out some of those issues in ways I think are accessible. Profoundly for progressives, whether we're doing electoral work or other sorts of organizing, I think it's the way that we speak is so important. Often we simply talk in shorthand to each other and expect that the more broad public, which is not immersed in progressive milieu, will sort of come along and get it. That doesn't work. We shouldn't be fighting for words. We should be struggling to implement a broad social vision with progressive policy that can be manifested in government. So I think we need to get rid of the jargon, in a way become more radical in the literal sense of going to the roots. Economic justice. Why is there so much wealth accumulating while there's so much unemployment and underemployment and scarcity and so forth? I think a progressive populism is absolutely essential, that breaks down these old barriers, that doesn't rely on what turns out to be soapboxing that is simply self-marginalizing. Let's assume that there's so many people we can make common cause with, not by watering down our politics, but by speaking in language and focusing on issues that we can see a shared vision together. I think one of the problems is that the mass media's cliches about the left-right spectrum have been unduly internalized by those of us on the left. And to fight for progressive populism is not simply to buy into a left-right spectrum. To buy into that spectrum is to empower the sort of the blue dog or corporate Democrat view that says that, well, you know, there's a strong right wing, so it's not realistic to fight for single payer. It's not realistic to stake out left positions because you kind of have to take what you get. And that, I think, is more apparent than real, because when you have a status quo that is absolutely unacceptable in social, economic, environmental, and warfare terms, then to simply say, well, the status quo cannot be opposed by anybody but the right wing, is in electoral terms a disaster. So to sort of sum up, I would say that we have to open up a real option inside and outside the electoral arena for progressive populism. And that gets rid of the idea that, hey, there's a left-right spectrum, you just drag it as far left as you can. In point of fact, it is a corporate power that is undermining the capacity of the Democratic Party to do anything other than replicate and rubber stamp some of these disastrous policies. We've got to offer something different, not by abandoning our principles, but by deepening them and fighting for the kind of solutions that say, hey, it doesn't matter what the label is, we want social justice, environmental protection, an end to the warfare state, and economic fairness that will really serve the people of this country.
I want to actually now even hone in further into the issues you just raised, in particular, use of the term progressive populism and the way that the left is framed in the media and how to combat it. If you look at the successful progressive left movements, revolutionary or reformist, over the past two centuries, basically going all the way back to the American Revolution, but particularly maybe from the French Revolution forward, where economic interests become very central, the left is telling people very simply, we are going to provide more prosperity for the vast majority of people, a better life, so in terms of education, health care, all of these issues that matter for people, we, not the right, are going to provide a better life for you, and we're also going to do it in a way, at least for the left movements that we, most of the listeners out there probably want to embrace, we'll do it in a way that maximizes liberty. That seems to be lost as something associated with the left by the general American population. These are really, really fundamental broad stroke framings. Yeah. What do you think about leading with those front and center?
Yeah, well, the corporate media have always been a perennial problem for progressives, because the way in which medias are framed and the left is tagged and stereotyped. At the same time, and I think this was true during the 1930s, the U.S. public tends to be very pragmatic. And if something can be shown to work, both in theory and in practice, including a jobs program, including Social Security, people will go with it. We have an opportunity to say that a broad progressive populism, or whatever it's called, challenges Wall Street. It does not accept the idea that some people don't have the human right to health care, does not accept the idea that because global warming continues and there's a coal and nuclear and other industry that ultimately thrives on the concentration of economic power to the destruction of the environment, that somehow we back off from those issues. On the contrary, I think we have this opportunity to reinforce and ring this bell constantly that we're all in this together, that we want to protect the economic security of everyone, the environmental protection of ourselves and the planet, et cetera, et cetera. And that means a direct populist challenge to the increasing consolidation of economic and political power by Wall Street and the financial services industries. That means clarity about where we are, and it means, if you will, polarizing with the corporate leadership that dominates so much of the Democratic Party.
And lastly, Norman Solomon, I want you to tell our listeners a little bit about the Roots Action Project that you're involved with.
I've been involved for the last year in the development of the RootsAction.org, which has just come out in the last couple of weeks here. Among our initial advisors, by the way, is Cornel West. And RootsAction.org is an online, avowedly progressive force that is organizing to mobilize, that is independent of all political parties, that will take on issues as we have. Our first action alert was issued by Daniel Ellsberg, challenging the war in Afghanistan and the White House that continues to escalate that war. And that's symptomatic. It's reflective, in, I think, a very positive way of how we will be distinct from, unfortunately, so many major liberal sort of online groups that have been unwilling to challenge this White House as it pursues these policies that are so destructive. So I'd invite people to go to RootsAction.org, sign up, become part of the process, because it is another way for us to educate, organize, and mobilize all at the same time.
Norman Solomon, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thanks, Alan.
Later in the show, we'll hear from Noam Chomsky and Cornel West. But up next, Ralph Nader. This is Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. I'm joined now by Ralph Nader, who I imagine needs no introduction. Public citizen number one for decades in the United States, Life magazine named him one of the 100 most important influential Americans of the 20th century, and a man who has run for the presidency of the United States a few times. Ralph Nader, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And can you simply just outline for folks your sense of how, in this historical moment, something that is absent from the current American landscape, a powerful left, could be revitalized?
Well, this is, of course, what astonishes all of us. There is a great deal of injustice throughout the land. It's getting worse. The vast majority of the people are being pushed down economically. They're being excluded, overcharged, disrespected, marginalized, entertained 24/7. And the commercialism is triumphing over civic values. And whenever a society subordinates, for a variety of reasons, civic values like access to justice and opportunity and a respect for posterity and many other aspects of civic values to the supremacy of commercial corporate values, a decay sets in, and we have a plutocratic and oligarchic society. So we know all this, but what is the great unanswered question is, why aren't people motivated to do something about it, either at the local, state, national level, in a whole variety of ways, from showing up with marches and demonstrations to how they choose their elected representatives, to how they use the courts, to how they make the educational system work, and so on. The lack of civic motivation is really the most important, because when you go around the country, people know there's so much that's wrong, and not just in terms of how they're mistreated and marginalized, but they know the trends are wrong. The trends are in the opposite direction, downward, one indicator after another. So I'd like to start by basically saying that the objectives, the redirections for our society, will be at the latter end of my brief remarks, and I want to start with the instruments. You can't get anywhere without having tools of democracy. Some of those are in our laws and constitution. They're not very widely used. Some of them are used and then they're abused. Law is often used as an instrument of oppression. And some of them are used, but not quantitatively enough. So let's start with finding 10 people from various backgrounds who work up an agenda of what kind of country and its place in the world people of good intention and just spirits would like. Once this agenda is worked up, and needless to say, we're in the golden age of muckraking books and policy books and documentaries going nowhere, unfortunately. But once this agenda is worked up, it cannot have a left label. Because, I mean, why handicap yourself? Furthermore, many of the things that I'm going to briefly mention could be supported by many people who don't call themselves left. They could be supported by libertarians, by authentic conservatives, by a variety of people in terms of how they identify themselves. So the agenda should be an agenda for justice, an agenda for cultural renewal, an agenda for environmental respect, and so forth. So 10 people get together and they hash out an agenda that they think will have wide support beyond any ideological niche or label. Then that goes to 1,000 people at a convention, which refines it, expands it, and dramatizes it. And then the next step, before the agenda is moved, 100,000 people in the country are asked to do the following. Do they agree with the agenda? Will they raise or contribute $200 a year? And will they contribute 200 volunteer hours a year, networked, heavily stratified in congressional districts? Because a lot of what needs to be done, inevitably, for the time being, has to go through Congress. And Congress is the Khyber Pass. It's a corporate Congress, but it's 535 people who put on their shoes every day like you and I. And thousands of organized people in congressional districts should be able to and make enormous headway here. And Congress, of course, vectors the executive branch and the judicial branch. It's the most important branch under the Constitution. So once that 100,000 reaches that critical mass, and basically it's a pledge, that is, I will pledge if 990,000 pledge, so that people realize that it's not going to just be petering out and 50 people pledge and nothing happens. The pledge builds up to a momentum so that you raise $20 million a year. And then that expands in trying to get some enlightened, older, super rich to put in hundreds of millions of dollars a year in order to organize every conceivable community in the country with full-time organizers selected by recruiters, finding the natural talent all over the country, and really getting a political and economic motivation plus a cultural motivation moving. So what kind of directions would there be? Well, the first on the agenda is, how do you shift power? How do you begin shifting power so the tools of democracy can be used by the people for a just society rather than the tools be used by commercial interests in just the opposite direction? And so there are all kinds of ways to do that once this basis that I just described is underway. You can do it by using the initiative referendum recall, by moving to get money out of politics, by refining the various strategies and tactics, by requiring inserts and mass mailings by corporations, banks, utility companies, and government, inviting people to join their own democratically elected nonprofit groups that a variety of advocacies and investigations and research and oversight. We need a crackdown on corporate crime. That requires, of course, adequate prosecutorial resources and a redefinition of the way corporate crime is treated in this country. We need a reduction in the military budget because that's destroying so much of our priorities. We need to get corporations off welfare. That's another distortion of public money. That is a zero-sum game and entrenches corporate power over our government, so we have a corporate government. We need fundamental tax return reform, where before you tax labor, you first tax those activities which society likes the least or dislikes the most. That is, transactions on Wall Street, massive derivative speculation produces huge amount of revenue, or you tax pollution, the carbon tax, you tax gambling, all the various things that you want the tax system to diminish before you start taxing labor. And then, of course, you bring your corporate taxes back so that capital gains are taxed like ordinary income, etc. Then we need a whole concept of community economics, community self-reliance to displace the dependency on absentee multinational corporate giants. The framework is already there. It needs to be invigorated and expanded. For example, credit unions reduce the power of the big banks. Food, local food, the power of the agribusiness, including cooperative housing, community health, community energy systems. They all reduce the power of the big health insurance companies and the energy companies. And that, of course, will be associated with single-payer health insurance. And then there needs to be, very quickly, the transition to solar energy and renewable energy from fossil fuels and nuclear. There needs to be science for the people. We have corporate science dominating academic science, which means it commercializes and politically controls what academic science can do. And we need to apply science to human needs, from modern mass transit to water conservation, soil erosion, many other improvements in consumer products. We need to open up the political and legal systems for the people. That means we expand access to the courts for injured people, for defrauded people, reduce the costs of judicial access, expand the services of lawyers for the people, as well as reforming electoral barriers to non-major party candidates so that there can be a real competitive democracy and people can have much more choices than the two-party dictatorships, choice Republican and Democrat. We need to also begin lifting the commercial exploitation of the family, especially the commercialization of childhood with violence, junk food, junk drink, all the things that are undermining parental authority, and advance ways to foster civic, spiritual, and aesthetic values. We need also civic skills and experience being taught in our schools, starting in elementary school, right through college. You have computer skills taught all the time. The most important skills that connect all knowledge are civic skills, classroom to community, back to classroom. We need to redefine the social compact with corporations, large corporations. We should have national charters, not Delaware charters or Nevada charters, which redefine the role of people, eliminate corporate personhood, and make sure that the stakeholders can hold these corporate bosses accountable, increasing investor rights and many other versions of corporate reform that a lot of people have worked on. We need to have foreign relations. We need to move from a military, imperialist, empire-oriented superpower to a humanitarian superpower as a basis for a muscular foreign policy. And sports are a huge area. We need to move from spectator sports, which dominate sports now, to participatory sports, participatory arts and crafts, to contrast with the commercialization that leaves people on couches, gaining weight, and not refining and expanding their own human talents. We need also simple facilities. As I earlier mentioned, I would call them checkoffs. When you get your electric telephone bill, when you get your bank or insurance bill, there's always that invitation to join the nonprofit groups of consumers, workers, taxpayers, investors, all the various constituencies that have been disempowered or stripped of any kind of participatory role in democratic policy making. We need to organize in every congressional district a minimum of 2,000 people called Congress Watchdog Associations. That's to achieve long overdue reforms and take control of Congress away from the corporate lobbyists in Washington, who hire ex-congressmen, who ply existing members of Congress with money, who put their executives in very high government positions in major departments, from Department of Interior, Department of Defense, and Treasury, etc. We need to address the people's commonwealth. The people in this country are the legal owners of the greatest wealth. That's the trillions of dollars in pension funds, one-third of America, all the wealth of the public lands, onshore and offshore. The public airways belong to the people. Trillions of dollars of government research and development, which have built so much of the aerospace, semiconductor, biotech, pharmaceutical, containerization, computer industries. All these are controlled by corporations, even though they're owned by the people. So we have to move from the Commonwealth ownership to Commonwealth control through a variety of intermediate associations, so that the corporations become our servants, not our masters. And finally, we need a tiny number of enlightened, super-rich, older Americans to continue to provide the resources and contacts for mobilizing communities throughout the country and facilitating and shoehorning more and more civic and political energy that the Constitution properly interpreted can encourage. Democracy, justice, they need money. Money for the people right down to the neighborhoods. And the left has never emphasized that enough, even though money from proper Bostonians fueled the abolition movement against slavery. Money from large rich families helped fuel the early civil rights movement, and we've got to focus more on that. And of course, that's one reason I wrote my book of political fiction called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, a top-down, bottom-up story of how to turn the country around. By the way, the title is in quotes. So these are some of the approaches that we have to engage in, and the bottom line is the public intellectuals of the left have their own careers. They're very comfortable, and they really don't connect enough with the agony and the grievances and the horrors that people have to go through here and what we're inflicting around the world. They have really isolated themselves, like the labor leaders have isolated themselves, not even going for repeal of Taft-Hartley, for example. So what we have to do is take people who are extremely serious, not just concerned, there's a big difference, extremely serious, to start ratcheting up this whole approach to engaging more and more people, more and more information, more and more gatherings, person to person. Email only goes so far throughout the country. If you look at justice movements in our past, it's because there were organizers, whether it's the abolition movement, civil rights movement, the farmer movement, the labor movement. You cannot have movements without organizers. You cannot have movements without person to person connections. And we've got all the technology now to notify each other, but very little technology to motivate each other. And I think in this manner, as I've outlined, we can get something underway.
Ralph Nader, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you for your series. I hope it catapults.
I'm Alan Minsky. The show is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Earlier today, I spoke with Cornel West at his hotel in Los Angeles. Cornel West is a professor at Princeton University. He's the author of countless books, including the classic Race Matters. He is co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Smiley and West, and he is one of contemporary America's leading public intellectuals. We're 3 years into the most intense economic crisis that we have seen in our lifetime. The economy and the society in many respects is clearly organized, and I think there's a general consciousness of this now, to the benefit of the few versus the welfare of the many. Classically, this would be an environment where a political left would flourish, and yet it seems that there is no coherent, powerful left in the United States. Your assessment of the political left in the United States?
First, just blessed to be here. Appreciate you putting on this wonderful series, though. But no, it's very clear that we've got financial oligarchs, we've got corporate plutocrats who have a disproportionate amount of influence, not just in government. They don't just colonize Congress. They don't just shape White House policies, but they shape media. So what they have been successful in doing in the last 35 or 40 years is as they deify Reagan, they demonize the left. They make it difficult for everyday people to gain access to any of the visions and the analysis, let alone the practices that the left enacts. So very few people even know about left organizations. Very few people know about the grassroots organizing that's going on, a left-wing trade unionists, or prophetic mosques, prophetic synagogues, prophetic churches, and so forth. We've been pushed so radically to the periphery and the margins that it's as if we're not just un-American, that we're relatively impotent, powerless, and have little to offer. But that's a lie. But that has to do with unbelievable, unprecedented, oligarchic and plutocratic influence, power, owing to not just the monies and resources, the wealth inequality and so forth, but to making available to everyday people alternatives to the present. And so we see the weapons of mass distraction. We see the obsession with surface issues, with superficial frameworks to understand the issues. And so everyday people feel what? Powerless, hopeless, hapless, and locked into instant gratification, fleeting pleasures, titillation of television, knowing that the whole system is rigged toward oligarchs and plutocrats against the demos, but feeling they can do very, very little. And then, of course, we also have a lot of deep divisions on the left as relatively weak at the moment as we are. But, I mean, I think we learned from Egypt, we learned from Tunisia that it's unpredictable when the demos wants to straighten its back up. And those of us who are committed to justice for poor people and working people, that we have to be there when the demos straightens its back up. It would be a marvelous thing to see the wave of massive demonstrations in Los Angeles, Chicago, against the White House, San Francisco, as we see in Liberation Square in Cairo. So we don't need to be too dark that trumps all possibility. We just have to continue to bear witness. We have to continue to tell the truth and recognize at the moment we're on the margin, no doubt about that. But the house of cards will fall and chickens come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. No lie lives forever.
It is an opening because right now the awareness that the system of American society is not functioning optimally and seemingly in reverse. From you to the American people, reintroducing the idea of what we call a left, but a politics that represents the interests of the vast majority of people.
First and foremost, we have to have the stress on the connection between the democracy deficit has something to do with the courage deficit, and it has something to do with the justice deficit. I'd call it a love deficit, which means what? Which means you have to have the courage to tell everyday people the truth, and when they hear that truth, they say, at least there's some people out there who have the courage to tell the truth, who are willing to try to bear witness to that truth, and that kind of witness can become contagious under certain circumstances. Those circumstances don't hold at the present, but they didn't hold 2-3 weeks ago in Egypt either, you see. Didn't hold 3 weeks ago in Tunisia or Yemen. And any time the demo straightens its back up anywhere in the world, it becomes contagious. Now, there is a rich democratic tradition within the American empire that we represent. So we have to convince our everyday people, when you think of America, think of a noble experiment in democracy that's profoundly flawed by oligarchic and plutocratic rule, and think of an empire with 800 military bases, a ship in every ocean, a military budget that's more than the combined military budgets of every other country in the world. That's the country we live in. That's the empire we live in. And more we need to say that. That's what I say everywhere I go. And it is catching on. It's getting traction. Ralph Nader, of course, has been the great figure in public life to do this kind of thing. And Noam Chomsky is, of course, the greatest public intellectual of our day. Thank God that there's a number of persons who still, like yourself and others, bear witness to this through media. And we just continually do our work, and when chickens come home to roost, we are ready to move in and say, you know what, poor people, you know what, working people, we never gave up on you. Look at the oligarchs and the plutocrats now. They are revealed for what they are, what they really are, which is driven by the greed, no real commitment to public interest, no commitment to common good, obsessed with their profits.
Since the financial crisis of 2007 and 2008, there has been a response from the populist right that, for the people participating in it, see it as opposed to Wall Street, or for many of the participants. What would you say to people in the general society in terms of economic policy? If you look at the long history of the left has been able to succeed over the past few centuries saying, we represent greater prosperity for the vast majority of people. We represent greater liberty. So in terms of the broad message, and in particular a focus on economics, how would you present the idea of participating? Come on over here to the progressive left where we are and participate in this movement, because we will bring you economic justice.
Well, I mean, one is we had to shatter the stereotypes that are bombarding fellow citizens in terms of who we are as progressives, who we are as a left, that actually we are not the freedom-hating, democracy-subverting crowd that you hear, not just on Glenn Beck and Company, but actually on a lot of mainstream media as well, so that at least people are able to gain access to what our vision, what our visions actually are, what our analysis actually are, and the kinds of work that we do. Now, we have to keep in mind, you know, the trade union movement put in a lot of people on the street. Not a lot of focus on that. I mean, John Stewart's marches can get more focused than trade union marches. Right. You see what I mean? Same would be true in terms of the march against the Koch brothers the other day. Not a whole lot of talk about that, but there are, in fact, activist groups out there that are doing things. It was just the Tea Party, owing to their tie to corporate elites, going to their tie to Wall Street, big money, Fox News and other organizations giving them a lot of play. They began as an inchoate group. They weren't that powerful. It was a surface group. They gained prominence and presence because of corporate media presence. And lo and behold, people began to think, oh, God, they're really something. They've got something going on. Next thing you know, it begins to take on real momentum. So we cannot downplay the role of corporate media in terms of projecting certain images that actually are far, far beyond what the reality was. Now, of course, the Tea Party movement is in some ways a classic right-wing populist movement, which is to say that they talk about the corruption of the government. They're right about that. The government is corrupt. There's no doubt about that. Their response is typical conservative and right-wing, which is anti-government, but they're not really anti-government. They are pro-military in ways that go beyond even Reagan in that regard, even in terms of certain social programs, like given the fact that the age a profile of so many in the Tea Party movement. They're not against Medicare. I mean, so that they're very selective, you see. They're not anti-government in terms of the carceral martial plan and the penal martial plan of the expansion of jails and prisons and the criminal justice system having big money. No, not at all. They don't sound too libertarian when it comes to that. Not at all. So if you look at the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex, which are always the two litmus tests for serious libertarians, no, they're very pro. Well, that's pro government. That's pro big public money. It's just that it's against certain folk. Mm-hmm. Poor people, working people, disproportionately people of color, and so on, you see. Same would be true in terms of gay brothers and lesbian sisters. They believe the government ought to intervene into their lives, keep track of what they're doing in the bedroom. I thought they were libertarian. No, the hypocrisy begins to surface, you see. What we have to do is steal the thunder from the right-wing populace. There are people in the Tea Party movement who hate the bailout of investment banks. I do, too. I'm in solidarity with those folks. It's just that it's expressed in a right-wing xenophobic way. How do we steal the thunder and get them to see that what we're talking about is corruption in government? Yes, agree with you. Anti-government? No. Democratizing government? Yes. For poor and working people, first and foremost, yes. Oh, we see. We want to cut back on military-industrial complex. We don't want an empire, right? We want a democratic republic. We want to be a nation among nations. Well, that's hard for them to take because the American exceptionalism is very deep, very deep. Well, we got to tell them the truth. American exceptionalism is, in fact, a house of cards. It's a house of cards that America is a nation and democratic and free to the degree to which citizens are courageous enough to fight for freedom and keep it democratic and expand the democracy. There's no special relation with God, no special relation or some providence and so forth and so on. It will go under like any other empire if we don't fight to keep it free and democratic.
I know for years you've been involved with the Democratic Socialists of America. A vision of society in terms of equity that you think would be a vision that could be accepted if articulated clearly for the American people, how that relates to issues like household welfare, education, healthcare.
Well, one is that first, if we begin with the notion that big finance and big business have thoroughly captured big government, then for me the question is, how do you empower poor and working people by, on the one hand, downsizing big finance and streamlining government to such a degree that government intervenes first and foremost to protect citizens and high priority of protecting poor and working citizens, the weak and the vulnerable. So that I actually have deep decentralizing tendencies that resonate with many of the fellow citizens who in no way consider themselves leftists. You see, I have a suspicion of bigness because it makes it difficult to set in place mechanisms of accountability for poor and working people, you see. Now, what does that mean? Well, what that means is they can't be too big to fail. Too big to fail really means too much political influence, and therefore they get what they want, and are too little to rescue working people's, poor people's. So priority must be on what? Schools, jobs with a living wage, quality housing, and trying to create a a context of a culture that's not so obsessed with titillation and stimulation and instant gratification and fleeting pleasures, but really talking about joy, talking about finding joy in community, talking about finding joy in working with others and serving others. So you also have a cultural and psychic and spiritual dimension that needs to be put forward, because I think a lot of people are very upset with the kind of spiritual malnutrition of late capitalist society, the kind of moral constipation of late capitalist society. They want to see a certain wholeness in terms of persons who are concerned with others and not just obsessed with themselves. They want to see some alternatives instead of the narcissism and the hedonism. They want to see much more sense of connection with others, empathy with others, those things that make us human at our best.
In American political discourse, spirituality in many respects has been ceded to the right. And your sense of how, given the makeup of the left, the strong strains of secular humanism that exist within the left, how that territory should not be or might not be ceded anymore to the right in the near future.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you look at three towering figures of the 20th century, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, Dorothy Day, Martin Luther King Jr., what was distinctive about each one of them? They knew there had to be a prophetic spirituality, not tied to institutions of religion per se, but a spirituality, a way of being in the world that focused on non-market values in a market-driven society. So that the non-market values of trust, of love, of loyalty, of justice, of fairness, all of those fly in the face of buying, selling, making, mending, manipulation, strategizing, Machiavellian calculation, and philosophic preoccupation. And I think Brother Michael Lerner has been very good on this. He's somebody we ought to take very seriously in terms of understanding what a progressive spirituality, a prophetic spirituality. It has to be ecumenical, because we know that our agnostic and atheistic brothers and sisters have been indispensable, have been fundamental in putting their lives and their bodies on the line in that regard. But at the same time, you got all these religious folk in the society, and they need to have access to a conception of themselves that's compatible with their religious beliefs, but also moves them in prophetic direction. Martin King understood this. Dorothy Day, of course, with the Catholic Workers Movement, understood this, and Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel understood it.
Because of what you just spoke about in terms of what I think is a very strong strain in the American polity of suspicion of bigness, but one of the ideas that is bandied about across the series, given the crisis of employment in the society, the sense that going forward, current American capitalism cannot provide full employment, the traction that is could possibly be achieved by putting forward public works as a full employment strategy. And your thoughts on that, and then maybe some ideas, because these have also been bandied about ways that these can be put forward but have a lot of local control and a lot more democratic control.
Exactly. Now, I think that even a progressive liberal like Brother Paul Krugman has been good on this. Joseph Stiglitz has been good on this, which is to say that it's possible to have a Marshall Plan tied to public-based, public-sphere jobs, building infrastructure and so forth. Mm-hmm. You can have a localized form that expresses, but it's still public and it's still the government. And I'm still very much for a government doing big things. But on the one hand, you see, you can do that, and you can then streamline or trim big government when it comes to the military budget. We can talk. They're already talking $1 trillion that can be shed. I think even more can be shed. That's money that could be used for other socially oriented purposes. So that when I talk about decentralization, I still recognize that certain kinds of centralization are here to stay. It's just a matter of trying to limit them as much as possible and to keep local autonomy and keep people's accountability at the center.
Cornel West, thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Thank you so very much. Stay strong. Keep up the good work, though, brother.
This is a historic time, when people in Egypt and across North Africa are rising up against autocratic regimes, regimes that have been propped up by the global superpower, the United States. The United States, under the guise of the economic Washington Consensus, also served as the prime driver of the economic instability that led to the intolerably low standards of living for the people now engaged in these popular revolutions. The 2007-2008 economic crash in the United States itself sent shockwaves around the globe. The crash itself was largely caused by a decade-long housing bubble, which in turn had its roots in the economic policies that had been in place for the previous few decades, beginning in the late 1970s, but pushed most notably by Ronald Reagan and Great Britain's Margaret Thatcher. This economic regime, often referred to as the TINA model, for there is no alternative, was organized around so-called free markets for the benefits of private capital and the wealthy. As we speak, this economic regime is in clear crisis around the world and in the United States. Noam Chomsky probably needs no introduction. He is an American dissident, cognitive scientist, and political activist. He is an institute professor and professor emeritus of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome, Noam Chomsky.
Glad to be with you.
You know, obviously the beneficiaries of the current economic order are prospering, continuing to prosper, but there's a great sense of crisis in the general population. That's acknowledged across the media. This is an economic crisis. So do you think that the trajectory of the American economy of the last three and a half decades, do you think that that system could in any way bounce back from the crisis to even create the illusion of prosperity? And I use the word illusion intentionally, because they, for more or less, have been able to maintain that for the past few decades. In other words, on their terms, do you think they'll be able to respond to this crisis before there's a severe public outcry in the countries of the core?
Well, the public has been sort of pacified with, as you say, illusions of some degree of prosperity, but it has been based on, it's been built on sand. I mean, most of the population has now lost most of their savings. People are going to have to survive on Social Security or what they have in the way of pensions, and that's being threatened. There's a major effort on the part of elite sectors to undermine and destroy the pension system and the Social Security system, again, with all kinds of fabrications. There's nothing being done, barely being done, you know, little Band-Aids here and there to try to deal with it. And it could lead exactly to what you're describing, massive public protest, which without organization, without labor unions, without left activist organizations, could take a very ugly form. It's happened before. There, I don't want to press the analogy too far, but it has certain similarities which have been noticed to late Weimar Germany. You focus your anger on vulnerable targets. Immigrants is the obvious one. So focus your anger on immigrants. This is an interesting campaign going on now, a very ugly campaign, to try to focus people's anger on public sector workers, right. Teachers, for example. They're the problem. Or pensions for police forces. That's the problem that's destroying us. Of course, it's total fabrication, but it's a familiar device, creating hysteria, you know, and fear in order to try to avert attention from the real issues. If there's no counter attack to that, it could succeed.
Well, how to revitalize that counter response? I mean, clearly, if you look at polls among the general population, a lot of progressive policy positions are actually widely embraced by the population. I think that there is a great consciousness that a society that has 2 million of its people in prison, that health and education, really quality health and education, are really only available to the rich, that there are unpopular imperial wars that are imposed on peoples around the world against their will, that there's broad economic decline with record-setting levels of unemployment and poverty. There's a general consensus that this society could work a lot better for the general population, among the general population, but there's no progressive political movement or just a vision for a more positive, better organized society that has coalesced and can be presented to the American people. So how can you see a left reemerging, reviving itself, given that there's fertile ground because there's such a crisis. How do you see that happening?
It's very fertile ground. I mean, there have been, for example, studies of a sample group of people who call themselves opponents of big government. You know, they want to get the federal government off their back, cut back government, and so on. Just that sample. It turns out when you go case by case that they have pretty much what are called social democratic attitudes. More spending for health, more spending for education, more spending to help the poor, but don't call it welfare because that's been demonized by Reaganite fantasies and so on. Mm-hmm. But across the board, that's pretty much the case. It was the same with the health program. That was pretty striking. There's now a majority of the population, small majority, who want to repeal the health reform. But if you look at their attitudes, what they're in favor of is things like, say, the public option. Obama gave that up in the face of approximately 2-to-1 support for it. So, yes, you're quite right. The basis is there for a serious left movement, but it has to be organized. I mean, this is not the first time in American history. We can learn some lessons from the past. The current the 1920s have a certain resemblance to what happened in the last decade, mm-hmm. Leading up to a comparable crash. And there were a couple of years after the crash was 1929. It was several years before any really concerted, organized popular movement developed to try to overcome the roots of the crisis. But it did. It was spearheaded by the labor movement. The labor movement had been virtually crushed in the 1920s. The United States has a pretty violent labor history, more so than other countries. But it reconstituted the CIO organizing sit-down strikes, which terrified the business classes because they're just one step short of taking over the factories and running them yourself, and other activism, which did help impel, in fact, substantially impelled the New Deal measures, which did improve things. I'm old enough to remember that. Most of my family was unemployed, working class. It gave a sense of hope, of purposefulness, and so on. A lot of these measures have, as long as they're in place, have been quite effective for the general population, media propaganda, and so on. That one thing that has to be done, if there's going to be any step forward, is organization of working people. There is no reason to have a huge, bloated financial sector, which is really parasitic on the society. Well, that doesn't have to exist. Those are government-created principles. There are simple ways of dealing with them, which, of course, aren't on the agenda because the financial institutions are too powerful. But one way to deal with the deficit, if you're worried about it, is with a transaction tax, mm-hmm. National transaction tax. It used to be called a Tobin tax, some small tax on short-term transactions, which would cut down very wasteful financial manipulations and bring in a ton of money. It is done elsewhere, even in England. But here it can't get onto the agenda. Financial institutions are too powerful. But it could happen. And as far as elimination of the manufacturing system, reduction of the manufacturing system is concerned, that can be overcome. I mean, take, say, green technology, which almost everyone recognizes is going to be a major a growth area, quite apart from its significance for doing something about the severe threat of climate change. It's a major growth area. Well, there is investment, and Americans do invest in green technology, but in China, not here. Here, the investors don't invest because there's no government support for it, no infrastructure, no stimulus, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't have to be the case. Those are political decisions. In fact, you can go on beyond that. I mean, when Obama took over the, pretty much took over a large part of the auto industry, there were many options that could be pursued. One is, would have been to convert it. Instead of closing down a GM plant, convert it to a production of, say, high-speed rail, which the U.S. desperately needs. In fact, at the same time plants are being closed here, the transportation secretary was in Spain trying to contract for production of high-speed rail in Spanish companies. Well, you know, those aren't laws of nature. Those are decisions. If the corporations don't want to do it, it's even a better solution. The plants can be taken over by the workforce and run efficiently. There are little bits and pieces of that, but that could be done much more extensively. Could be quite profitable and could be good for the society and the economy. And there's case after case like this. But these things have to be brought to public consciousness and awareness. And people have to be organized to try to do something about them. Well, those are big tasks, but there aren't any magic keys.
Right.
It has to be done the same way it was done in the past.
Well, there certainly are obstacles to getting a left message out in America. And maybe you ended on a point relevant to the final question I have, which are just any advice you may have from your career of looking at media discourse in the United States and the left across the world in the United States, any advice you might have as to how to overcome the obstacles that exist for organizing a left and getting a left message out in the United States?
I think actually we know the answers. As I said, there are no magic keys. It takes hard work. We can see we know the effectiveness of these measures from our own history. I mentioned a couple of examples. And what's right at this moment, we can see it. I mean, you mentioned what's happening in the Arab world. It's pretty spectacular. In fact, it's the greatest popular uprising that I can remember. It's quite remarkable. These are people who have lived through a very long period of repression, brutality, violence, economic destruction, also through neoliberal measures, which, say, in Egypt, did raise growth rates and created a sector of extreme wealth, but not the population. They suffered from it, as in most places. Well, they're, to everyone's surprise, rising up under conditions far harsher than any that we face. And it's not magic. It takes work, energy, dedication, commitment, willingness to face the problems that are going to arise, nowhere near as severe here as they are, say, in Egypt. But, you don't get praised and rewarded by the powerful for trying to create a more just society. You don't expect that. But the benefits can be overwhelming. Has to be done, that's all.
Noam Chomsky, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Glad to talk to you.
Well, folks, our week-long series is over, but the project has just begun. As I said at the top of the week, the most important effect a series like this can achieve is simply to bring this issue front and center, and not turn away from the truth that there is no socially powerful political movement in the current United States that is advocating on behalf of the vast majority of people. It's desperately needed, so let's get to it. I want to thank our guests on today's show, Norman Solomon, Ralph Nader, Cornell West, and Noam Chomsky. And thanks indeed to the production assistants on this series, Evan Kendall, Vanessa Gonzalez, Martina Steiner, Spencer Downing, engineers Mark Maxwell and D'Angelo Jones, and Melisa Figueroa, the webmaster for buildingapowerfulleft.org. You can hear this and all previous shows from the series on kpfk.org, as well as buildingapowerfulleft.org. And in the coming days, You'll be able to hear the full versions of all the interviews that were done for the series up on the website, buildingapowerfulleft.org. You only heard excerpts during the week. And don't forget, in the days and weeks ahead, check out wikileft.org. I'm Alan Minsky. The series is Building a Powerful Left in the United States. Let's get to it.